If you haven't read the policy on the back of our periodical, you should. It is not only the basis for the operation at any ULT, wherever in the world it is situated, it is also one of the freest. It asks nothing of you except what you want to give. It's independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. And in an effort to do this, the associates give freely of their time and their money and their effort in studying to voluntarily give out these teachings to a starving world. Wherever in the world you go and find a ULT, you will find the same material being used. Original writings of Madame Blavatsky and her co-worker William Q. Judge. There are no distinctions made as to gender or condition. Anyone is welcome to attend, and anyone is welcome to become an associate. Again, all that is asked of anyone is independent devotion and a realization that universal brotherhood is a fact. It's not an ideal. It already exists, and as we act outside of that as though it isn't real, we harm ourselves because we are part of that brotherhood. So again, we recommend reading it. Now we're having a new, not new, but different for us. We have not studied the Light on the Path as a group in many, many years. So in one way, it's very exciting. In another way, if you've looked at the material, it ain't easy. That so many, for instance, if you were called upon to give a summary today, there's so many potent, wonderful things you could talk for 2 days and not give enough. So you will understand why it will be succinct as a summary and why we will jump around, obviously. But we wanted to introduce it since many of you may not have heard of Light on the Path. HPB wrote in a little article called Spiritual Progress, "Whatever differences are to be found in the various presentations of the esoteric doctrine, as in every age it donned a fresh garment, different both in hue and texture to that which preceded. Yet, in every one of them, we find the fullest agreement upon one point, the road to spiritual development. One only inflexible rule has been ever binding upon the neophyte, as it is binding now, the complete subjugation of the lower nature by the higher. From the Vedas and Upanishads to the recently published Light on the Path, search as we may through the Bibles of every race and cult, we find but one only way, hard, painful, troublesome, by which men can gain the true spiritual insight." And then from another article, in her literary jottings section in the December 1888 issue of Lucifer magazine, H.P. Blavatsky remarked that this little book, Light on the Path, a true jewel, belongs to and emanates from the same school of Indo-Aryan and Buddhist thought and learning as the teachings in the secret doctrine. So you might not ever have heard of it, but it is part of one and the same teachings. Now we'll have a summary attempt. Good luck.
Okay, we just wanted to add one thing to the introduction, that the word treatise, originally the root, it means to treat, to, you know, it's a treatment of something, but it also means a handle. It meant originally a handle as well. So we're thinking about, you know, this is something we're trying to get a handle on, literally, and to wrap our minds around, because it's written, you know, it's the Eastern wisdom, and it speaks to the heart, and it's really wonderful. It's beautiful. So, Light on the Path begins with some actually unwritten rules. Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. Before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must have lost the power to wound. And before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. So there's actually four unwritten rules that begin this treatise. Some of these things may sound counterintuitive, but that's the whole point, to think about it. So we're told to, in a number of rules, we're told to kill out ambition, desire of life, and desire of comfort. So in killing selfishness, we live for others, and one is not disappointed, because ambition is a curse and a tempter. In the end, it is realized that to work for self is to work for disappointment. So we need to replace the fleeting by the everlasting. And we're supposed to work for those that are ambitious, meaning ambitious for their own advancement, competitive. But we are to be competitive in a sense, if we can use that word, not for ourselves, but for others. So only the strong can kill out this desire that lives, the selfish desire that lives fruitfully in the heart. And it lives fruitfully in the heart of the devoted disciple as well. So we should not try to separate ourselves in any way from those that may not be actively seeking the path. However, everyone is really on the path. And there's many, many ways to the goal. So it says that only the strong can kill it out. The weak must wait for its growth, its fruition, and its death. So this is a path of power, and we need to tear this thing, this competitive, ambitious nature, meaning for selfish means, we need to tear it out of our heart. So this is an ordeal that must be endured, and it may come at the first step of the perilous ladder, which leads to the path of life, or it may not come until the very last. Then we're counseled to live neither in the present nor the future, but in the eternal. And it says this giant weed cannot flower there. You know, it's because it is like a weed, ambition that we're so permeated with. in today's world. So 5, 6, and 7 talks about, rules 5, 6, and 7 talk about killing out the sense of separateness, desire for sensation, and hunger for growth. So we're told to learn from sensation and observe it, because only so can you commence the science of self-knowledge and plant your foot on the first step of the ladder. Grow as the flower grows, unconsciously, but eagerly anxious to open its soul to the air. Or like the lotus that opens its heart to the morning sun and the dew. So it's the eternal that draws us forth. There's much strength and beauty, and we are to develop in the luxuriance of purity instead of trying to harden ourselves by forcible passion for personal stature. We're going to skip over the next three rules, or four, because this is a summary and there's much here. So, then on page 6, we're told to desire power ardently, desire peace fervently, and desire possessions above all. So here's this counterintuitive. What are these possessions? So they are the possessions that belong to the pure soul only. They are possessed by all souls equally in reality. So this hunger for such possessions can be held by the pure soul, that you may accumulate wealth for that united spirit of life, which is your only true self. The peace you shall desire is that sacred peace which nothing can disturb, and in which the soul grows as does the holy flower upon the lagoons. So they're referring to the lotus there. And then here, this is a very interesting jewel to think about. And that power which the disciple shall covet is that which shall make him appear as nothing in the eyes of men. So, perhaps we'll have some discussion on that. And we're told to seek out the way. Seek out the way by retreating within. And then we're told to seek out the way by advancing bodily without. So it seems like a contradiction, but actually there are many ways, there are many paths, and we should try them all. All steps are necessary to make up the ladder. The vices of men become steps in the ladder, one by one, as they are surmounted. The virtues of man are steps indeed necessary, not by any means to be dispensed with. The whole nature of man must be used wisely by one who desires to enter the way. Each man is to himself absolutely the way, the truth, and the life. So that is, of course, discussed in the Bible. But the way and the truth must come first, and then the life can be lived. So, ways to seek this path, it says, some of the ways, seek it by plunging into the mysterious and glorious depths of your inmost being. Seek it by testing all experience, by utilizing the senses in order to understand the growth and meaning of individuality, and the beauty and obscurity of those other divine fragments which are struggling side by side with you. So we're all fragments, we're all arrays of the divine. seek it by study of the laws of being, the laws of nature, and the laws of the supernatural. So we will end there.
Bravo. Does everyone have the handout? So, okay. When a page number is referred to, it's not the page number on the bottom, but within the text. We're talking about a little book, this big, yeah, a very little book. And if you look, it'll say like page 7. It's in parentheses. So if a page is referenced, it's not the reference number on the bottom. Well, you've certainly heard a lot of it. Did you have questions or thoughts? Yeah.
Well, on the title page, the first sentence in the book is that it's written for the personal use of those who are ignorant of the Eastern wisdom and who desire to enter within its influence, which is a really big statement because people who, so to speak, in plain language, people who know nothing about theosophy, ignorant of the Eastern wisdom, who pick this book up first, pretty much still know nothing about theosophy, it seems. Because this is like, it's so deep. What a person completely ignorant of theosophy appreciate?
Well, it may be deep, but it's no different from the teachings of the Buddha. It's no different from the Sermon on the Mount. So the problem is there's no word in it that says theosophy. So somebody could pick up this book, you know, in a bookstore and never realize what it leads to. But of course, the occult teachings say if your mind and heart is set on that devotion to these ideas, you will find the wisdom religion. It's part of your past anyway, but you will connect with it. Well, on page 2, seek in the heart the source of evil and expunge it. What do you think that is? It says it's even in the heart of the devoted disciple. What is this evil? Yes?
Well, I think it's two things. It's ambition and feeling separate from our fellows.
Put those two together,
they work together,
and you have selfishness.
Right, they work.
And that's what it is. This is from some of the Mahatma's writings. Evil is the exaggeration of good and the result of human selfishness and greed. The origin of every evil, whether small or great, is in human action, in man whose intelligence makes him the one free agent of nature. Even diseases, according to the Mahatma, are created by man. They are brought about by excesses in food, sexual relations, or drink. Nature intends human beings to die a natural death by old age, as seen among wild animals or savages, barring accidents. Ambition or goal seeking are natural, but when pursued with selfishness, they create misery. Therefore, it is neither nature nor an imaginary deity that has to be blamed, but human nature made vile by selfishness. Why do you think that happens? How did we get in that condition? When we came in incarnating into these human forms, we were evidently full of hope and joy and determination to learn all there was to learn on this planet, to help the lower intelligences move upward in their potential, and to spread joy and love, and because we had no needs beyond devotion. Yes.
Maybe part of that problem is in the sentence where it was said that man is the only free agent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because all of the lower kingdoms operate, they have
no
choice.
I don't know if everyone can hear you.
All the lower kingdoms have no choice but to operate perfectly with the natural law. And those above man have already made the choice and only
right.
do.
Right.
So then this evil probably has to do with our option to choose.
And we need that ability. If we couldn't make choices, how could we grow? If we couldn't learn, and that's the point in one of this thing, you have to understand evil and understand desire and understand selfishness and ambition and then stand away from it and live without it bit by bit. Yes.
Well, the whole idea with the ambition.
Louder.
The whole idea with ambition, I mean, don't we need ambition to progress, to want to study? So, I mean, there's that duality that we know exists.
Right.
So, it says kill out ambition. It's not saying kill
yes.
out ambition for
right.
know, the negative. It sounds like it's just talking about blanket.
But then number four, work as those work who are ambitious. It's the intention with which we use something. If we're ambitious for ourselves and what we can have and what our family can have, that's selfish. But if we're ambitious to acquire wisdom and to do the best we can for our family, but look down on no one. Seek it not. This is on five. Seek it not by any one road. To each temperament, there is one road which seems the most desirable, but the way is not found by devotion alone, by religious contemplation alone, by ardent progress, by self-sacrificing labor, by studious observation of life. None alone can take the disciple more than one step onwards. Does that perhaps tell you something about your own past? Yes.
We reached a lot of dead ends.
Yeah, but we reached them.
Right.
Which, you know, it's... he invented the light bulb. Who invented the light bulb? Edison?
Really. Edison.
Edison's comment is so perfect for this. When somebody said, you know, wasn't it awful and horrible wasting all that time to have whatever it was, 96 things that didn't work? And he said, but how could I find what did work if I didn't know what didn't work? Yes.
Maybe the better term would be a cul-de-sac, because then it's kind of rounded and we turn around and we go back to the drawing board, as it were.
Yeah, but the whole problem is we don't digest the lessons. That's what makes it a dead end. We think, oh, that happened to me because my boss didn't like me. and so we didn't promote me. Or that happened to me because my parents were terrible to me. They really, really made a mess of me. Or. We're always blaming others. And if you do that, how can you grow when you're the problem? So we have made progress. We don't know which way. It might be interesting to stop and think about yourself as you know yourself right now. What are you really good at? Really, really good at from birth? Does it fit in one of these categories? What are you pretty good at learning about? Does it fit under one of these categories? We all have skills and talents, but we can't express them in this life. Yes?
Could we read that first sentence to in the declaration and start from there?
Where did you want it to start?
The first sentence of paragraph of
and the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. Yes, and that's the whole point. As thinkers, we incarnate to grow and to share. And the evil that sets in is that we think we're separate. And if we're separate, we have to do everything for ourselves. We don't have to trust anything. Or we get into a religious fervor where someone is going to save us eventually. So we don't do the necessary things. But to be even considering a book like this is the necessary thing. It tells us there is work to be done. We think this is such an interesting statement. The vices of men become steps in the ladder, one by one. Again, it's page 5. As they are surmounted, the virtues of man are steps indeed necessary, not by any means to be dispensed with. Yet, though they create a fair atmosphere and a happy future, they are useless if they stand alone. In other words, sort of racking up points for your virtues is not going to take you to the goal of self-knowledge, spiritual wisdom. So it isn't just virtues. The whole nature must be used wisely by the one who desires to enter the way. To do this, we're told, and it uses the word individuality, which really means personality here. Yes?
Well, there's no mention of, having a teacher or any kind of systematic approach to doing this. Most of the traditions, I think of Buddhism and Hinduism, speak of the necessity of having a teacher. This is very high-minded, but just to plop down and read this book and saying, I'll just work on it myself, seems a little, little far-fetched in this day and age. So does the author at all point to the requirement
No, but one of the major themes in occultism is when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. So in other words, we have to do this, at least show that we're devoted to accomplishing this. And even in the beginning, you can suddenly find a book or a friend makes a comment and you realize, ooh, that answers my question. You can find teachers, in quote, before you find the teaching. It's a path, and you follow it, and you come to what you need. Why? Because you are a spiritual being, and life is spiritual. So you can't fail if you follow this path. Yes?
And the philosophy also talks about self-induced. And
I don't think people can hear you.
And the philosophy also talks about self-induced and self-devised mm-hmm. means, that the expectation is that we will study on our own, we will help others. Now, we will take the philosophy out of the lodge when we leave mm-hmm. and put it into practice. We won't, we're not going to have like some kind of a, like a minister or a priest tell us what we have to
right.
believe. We have to do it on our own.
And that's an important idea to realize. The theosophy does not tell you. What it tells you is this is the law, this is the result if you go against that law. The law is brotherhood. What is the result if you go against it? You fall into selfishness and separateness, and your karma will bring you to a hideous life with no one around you. Continuing in this right here, each man is to himself absolutely the way, but he is only so when he grasps his whole personality firmly and by the force of his awakened spiritual will recognizes this individual, this personality, as not himself, but that thing which he has with pain created for his own use, and by means of which he proposes, as his growth slowly develops his intelligence, to reach to the life beyond personality. And that's following on six. But the point is, we have to right now say, oh, this personality I created with pain, and we know the painful things just in this life that we're creating for the next personality. It is a combination of our will, our intent, our actions, and we build that personality. We have no one to blame. We may say we carry a trait genetically from our family, but that's not the source of our problem. We're born into that family because it suits our needs, because we carry the whole formula of our past within our spiritual nature. And it will, in some life, have the growth from certain seeds that have been buried for years. Yes?
So suppose then if we went back to one of the first questions or issues that arose, seek in the heart the source of evil and expunge it. If we accept that, you know, nothing other than man can be evil because they don't have a choice, perhaps the source of the evil is the fact that man can look at either himself or his effects or the things that he does mm-hmm. and create, based on that, a false personality and say, that's what I am. I'm not my spiritual self, but I am the stuff, the conditions that are around me that I involve myself in, and that's the beginning of the end. conditions.
Right, but you can't say, I am the conditions.
That's the issue. That we mistakenly
right.
do so. And
right, right. Instead of, I am the creator of this, and who else could change it? It starts with being honest with ourselves and, you know, maybe even writing a list of our worst faults and then pick one and work on it. But theosophy says we don't kid ourselves into thinking because we speak differently and act differently that we have acquired the other virtue. We have to examine ourselves, watch ourselves in action, find out what are we after? What is our intention? And then we can begin to change it if we have the courage. Okay. When he knows for this is page 6, that for this his wonderful, complex, separated life exists, then indeed, and then only, is he upon the way. Seek it by plunging into the mysterious and glorious depths of your own inmost being. Theosophy says, within us already resides wisdom, that we have to work our way back to it by stopping the fascination with the physical, sensual, material world. Yes?
Well, we don't know if anybody else finds it a little strange in that sentence where it says his wonderful, complex, separated life.
Yeah.
But separate from whom?
That we have a separated life. That's why. That's where we can make these choices. Only the human has a choice because it stands between two things. I can do this or I can do the opposite. And it can look at them and know them for what they are. The one is selfish, the other is ethical and uplifting. But that's why the separated life exists. If we were just in our spiritual nature as thinkers, what would we have? We would know we're all one, so there'd be no judgment about anybody else. We would know that we are eternal and that we will move through various forms so that we can gain experience and wisdom. So as thinkers. And it is said that we do this every night in deep sleep. We stand as our own higher nature. And we can't bring it back because our language, our behavior in our daily life prevents us. That we should cultivate that. Read a devotional book. Well, not a whole book. Read from a devotional book before you go to sleep. Don't think about all the things on this plane. Think about spiritual life. And eventually you'll start remembering little hints from deep sleep. Or if you don't, you will wake up in the morning going, ah, it's all right. Because it is all right. When we finish this life, and we assimilate the best of it, that's the end of this personality. And then we're going to have a different one. Hopefully better, because we've made some progress. We've made some effort. It is said that when we leave that heaven state, we see, I guess it would be like a synopsis of the future, of the life that is to come. And because we, as a thinker, know we created those causes, we accept it. And we understand it is perfectly just. And then a veil comes down. A veil that is necessary, because you wouldn't learn if you already knew all of this spiritual idea of life. You've got to learn it here. Yes, you had your hand up?
Yeah, on page 6, I mean, in parentheses, page 6, paragraph.
Yeah.
Like it says, seek it by testing all experience, by utilizing the senses in order to understand the growth and meaning of individuality, the beauty and obscurity of those other divine fragments, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, even that, seek it by testing all experience, by utilizing, that just sounds like, it reminds me of like Carlos Castaneda books, like Don Juan, Journey to Ixtlilxochitl, where he has a master. He meets Don Juan, this native, like mystic who leads him on the path and step by step helps him to discover parts within him. This to do this without a teacher, without anybody there guiding you, it could be dangerous.
Yes, that's what we've all been doing all of our lives on Earth.
And also to seek it by testing all experience. Well, you end up going down all these different roads and avenues, and maybe wasting a lot of time discovering something. Whereas if you had a teacher, then they can help crystallize.
Yes. But you have to earn that. But another thing is, Theosophy tells us we've been incarnating for 18 million years. You've had all experiences. You must have. But the problem is, we haven't tested them. What does testing mean? Doesn't it mean thinking about it, comparing it, understanding the experience? Isn't that what testing means? It doesn't mean run out and shoot somebody, because that's an experience and now I know. It means what you choose, what has already happened to you, or even observing somebody else. We can learn a lot from watching somebody else. We gather that information, weigh and consider it, and come to a conclusion. Yes?
This is on page 47, so it's going to be several weeks before we get to this point, but it is germane to the discussion, because it says that the voice of the masters is always in the world, but only those who hear it, whose ears are no longer receptive to the sounds which affect the personal life. Laughter no longer lightens the heart, anger may no longer enrage it, tender words bring it no balm. For that within, to which the ears are as an outer gateway, is an unshaken place of peace in itself which no person can disturb. So we're to become receptive to the master's voice, which is within us.
Right.
That's where the true master
right.
is. It's not somebody outside. Although there are masters that work in the world within a body or out of a body. But the true master is within ourselves, and we're to become receptive to the promptings of the soul.
And how do we do that? These are statements to tell us how to become receptive. But it doesn't mean if we get a good beginning in this, that one of the masters, someone who has already gathered to themselves all the wisdom that is possible on this planet and stands as a light for their fellow human beings. We are the younger brothers. We're identical to the Buddha. Only the Buddha knows. We only hope. We haven't learned yet. So it doesn't mean that we're going to go, wow, now I have a master. It means that as we make this preliminary, we start meeting people like a group of students. We start reading different books, thinking differently. We start finding that we are teaching ourselves because of our devotion. And it cannot go too far without some help coming to you. Yes.
Yes, and masters are working for all of humanity,
mm-hmm.
not for individuals. Although, from time to time, certain individuals are influenced directly by masters, but they're ones who are working for all humanity. So, you know, behind movements. So they use their time wisely by inspiring those who are in movements that are altruistic and for all of humanity.
But back to testing. If we have that urge for a teacher and we follow these rules, we will have a teacher. It will not be as you expect, maybe, but we will have someone who knows more and leads us to a different point. Yes?
I just noticed that at the beginning here it says, and remember this was written in 1870.
No, 1884.
Okay, 1884. So at that time, I mean, this is written in people in the West, most of them that maybe would have come to theosophy, maybe they had never had read a book on Buddhism or Hindu philosophy, because at that time, you know, we were in such a Judeo-Christian country,
well,
world.
Well, how many people have read a Hindu thing in this?
If you go to self-help section, if you go to an independent bookstore, you see so much about Buddhism, so much about yoga and things, so Eastern philosophy, and because there are a lot of Easterners living in the West, or Westerners living, so we're in this, you know, we're in such a totally different world. But it says, written for the personal use of those who are ignorant of the Eastern wisdom. And I wonder if the intention was for people who had never even heard anything about the Buddha or read any book about Buddhism, never attended a meditation seminar, never went to read up on yoga and, you know, different things, which would have been the majority of people.
Exactly.
Those days. Whereas today, you know, if you talk to so many people, they comparative religion, they, you know, do yoga, or just they're interested, or know a little bit about, or they have Asian friends, you know, there's just much more mingling and stuff. So ignorant of Eastern wisdom suggests that maybe she meant people that,
okay,
yeah, didn't know anything. This would be the first step.
She says that these were not her ideas, not her words, that she was an amanuensis and an adept was giving her the material, not in physical life. She did it psychically. And I don't know if that dedication was written by her or was a statement by him. That Eastern wisdom is what's being pictured here.
May I just add something to your statement? It's a two-pronged approach. It's a compound sentence. So it's for those who are ignorant of Eastern wisdom, that's one group, and for those who desire to enter within its influence.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, who wouldn't be considered ignorant of the Eastern wisdom then?
Well, of course, there were many, many people interested in Eastern wisdom because of the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. And there were very popular things going on about it. But the fact is that this did not invite you to a particular study. And it didn't tell you, here's the teacher, here's where you go. And theosophy is not that kind of teaching anyway. It doesn't dictate to you it exposes things to you about the real, true spiritual nature of you and of all of life. And if you transgress it, what you bring on is your own punishment, or really it's an education. You will suffer what you have done to someone else, and you will learn what it's like, and you'll never do it again. That is how we learn and grow. It takes a long time. 18 million years, we should have been better than this by now. Yes?
As regards having a teacher, it's natural. It's just so natural that, you know, if you have a big thing to learn, you want somebody to show you how to do it. It's just the natural way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take ourselves out of theosophy and just use an analogy. If a young person goes to college his freshman year, you know, like a AAA rated college in sports, walks on the baseball field and tells the coach, all right, and he's never swung a bat before. The coach, like this legit high-ranking coach who has a lot of credibility, is going to look at this kid and he's like, bro, you missed the boat, you're not ready. Now, take this guy back in time, and if when he was a little boy, first, second, and third grade, he was on the Little League, and really it's the guy's, his friend's father down the street who's the coach. Well, if he follows everything that really it's just my friend's dad, but he's the coach and he respects what the coach says, then when he gets to junior high and high school, on the one hand, well, it's really just an English teacher. He's not some kind of master in baseball, but he's helping me and I respect what he's doing, and he's a coach. He knows more about baseball than I do. And then finally, when you get to college, maybe you're ready. However, the child who's like, he's not really a coach, he's my friend's dad, and then goes to junior high and high school and says, he's a coach, but not really. He's an English teacher, so he doesn't really know. So I'm not going to, you know, by the time he gets to college, still, you're not ready. So the issue is not how good is my teacher, how advanced is my teacher. The issue is,
am I
willing to accept, and is my intuition open to some of these things from people who we may not even know they're our teacher? Yet we may have known them for 15 years,
right,
and then eventually see them for something different or something more than we saw years ago.
Because we change.
Then it's a, right, so right. The change is in us. So the teachers probably are all around us. And until we're willing to accept that, why ever would a master of wisdom take us under his discipleship?
Right. Even a high disciple of a master helps by impressing something like this book so that we have it. But it's what we do with it. It's one thing to own a book, it's another to digest it and make it part of your active life. It's your choice. Yes.
Well,
speak up.
Well, when we were jump into college right away, we had to pass through all of those preliminary grades and qualify ourselves to go higher. So what is it mean by a disciple? And what does it mean by disciplinary process? And the little yellow pamphlet we have tells us right at the top. Now, it says here, this is written down with notes and comments by the author.
Yeah, but we can't get to those because that will steal the thunder for the coming weeks. And this is a little book, but it's a lot of little book. But the fact is, that's back to the ambition question. We need to fire ourselves up. We have to be as ambitious as someone who's doing it for their personal self. We have to, and I think we all see it. We hear on the news or we walk by someone and we realize there's so much suffering out there. And how do I help? I can't feed the world. I can't change the political conditions. How do I help? If we go after with great ambition to understand life and ourselves. What are my powers? How do I use them? What am I capable of? What could I change now? We have something, yeah, that was written down. We need soul medicine. We need to read and study the thoughts of the Buddha, along with the Sermon on the Mount, the teachings of the Stoics, every devotional book, and find the one that is written for us now in order to see what is our problem and how we begin to change ourselves by degrees. In this effort, we begin to attract to us better ideas, because ideas are real. Thoughts are things. We can attract the thoughts of the teacher, and we'll know that it's a higher thought. Fellow searchers will show us where we can find those great thinkers who have been holding the method for growth for eons and offer it freely. The only cost is our own effort. What, then, can stop you from beginning this? Even if you just take one thing that you want to change about yourself. I'm quick to lose my temper with people who are selfish. Well, don't do that. And start by realizing that their selfishness must have a cause, and you must have a glimmer of that cause, or it wouldn't bother you. So you begin looking at it. Remember, it says you can't step aside from the bad man or the evil man. We are all one. Those germs are in us, and they've either been had their potential destroyed by our growth, or they're there as a seed for the future. Yes.
Well, there's a mysterious statement that the power which the disciple shall covet is that which shall make him appear as nothing in the eyes of men. So it seems counterintuitive. How can you help others if you don't stand out? As basically, what we're conditioned for, we think.
Those who know are humble. Why? Because that knowing just means that you understand you always knew, you just didn't reflect on it, you just didn't live it, you didn't touch it. Of course they want to appear as nothing, because otherwise you change the whole tenor of things. You follow someone then, instead of following the ideas that come from them. The true teacher never asks anything of you but to listen. You know, in the Gita, which we're studying on Wednesday nights, and this Wednesday the topic is the yoga doctrine, but not the way you would think of yoga. You'll see. But anyway, the entire book, the whole wisdom that keeps being laid out for Arjuna by Krishna leads to the last statement. And he says, act as seemeth best to thee. The teacher has been teaching him all along and then says, you have to make the choice. You have to act. Well, our meeting is adjourned, and Wednesday night, open at 5:15 for the library until 7:15, and then the meeting from 7:30 to 8:30.